Blog Talk Radio.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Okay, we had a little bit of a problem, and I did.
And I have something to start it with.
Hello, I am Elmer J. Fudd. Republican commentator Rush Limbaugh has endorsed me to replace Mitt Romney as the Republican nominee for president. Like Mr. Romney, I am a millionaire. I own a mansion and a yacht. I have not released my tax returns, and I have no political convictions, although I do love guns.
Well, we also have, we got to catch up here because we were cut off the air for some reason. I have no idea, but just listen to this. They're going to be playing something right now.
Hello?
Am I? Yes, hello. Hold on.
Mike? Okay.
Yes.
Michael, it's Craig Madden.
Yes, hold on, Craig.
I can't get nothing else.
What is going on here?
No, I'm going to hold you to an answer on that. What makes America the greatest country in the world?
Well, Lewis and Sharon said it, diversity and opportunity and freedom and freedom.
I'm not letting you go back to the airport without answering the question.
Our Constitution is a masterpiece. James Madison was a genius. The Declaration of Independence is, for me, the single greatest piece of American writing.
You don't look satisfied. One's a set of laws and the other's a declaration of war. I want a human moment from you. What about the people? Why is America
not the greatest country in the world, Professor? That's my answer.
You're saying
yes. Let's talk about...
Fine. Sharon, the NEA is a loser. Yeah, it accounts for a penny out of her paycheck, but he gets to hit you with it anytime he wants. It doesn't cost money. It costs votes. It costs airtime and column inches. You know why people don't like liberals? Because they lose. If liberals are so fucking smart, how come they lose so goddamn always?
Hey.
And with a straight face, you're going to tell students that America is so star-spangled awesome that we're the only ones in the world who have freedom? Canada has freedom. Japan has freedom. The UK, France, Italy, Germany, Spain, Australia, Belgium has freedom. So 207 sovereign states in the world, like 180 of them have freedom.
All right.
And yeah, you, sorority girl, just in case you accidentally wander into a voting booth one day, there's some things you should know. And one of them is, there is absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country in the world. We're 7th in literacy, 27th in math, 22nd in science, 49th in life expectancy, 178th in infant mortality, 3rd in median household income, number 4 in labor force, and number 4 in exports. We lead the world in only 3 categories. Number of incarcerated citizens per capita, number of adults who believe angels are real, and defense spending, where we spend more than the next 26 countries combined, 25 of whom are allies. Now, none of this is the fault of a 20-year-old college student, but you nonetheless are, without a doubt, a member of the worst period, generation, period, ever, period. So when you ask what makes us the greatest country in the world, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Yosemite? Sure used to be. We stood up for what was right. We fought for moral reasons. We passed laws, struck down laws for moral reasons. We waged wars on poverty, not poor people. We sacrificed. We cared about our neighbors. We put our money where our mouths were, and we never beat our chest. We built great big things, made ungodly technological advances, explored the universe, cured diseases, and we cultivated the world's greatest artists and the world's greatest economy. We reached for the stars, acted like men. We aspired to intelligence. We didn't belittle it. It didn't make us feel inferior. We didn't identify ourselves by who we voted for in the last election, and we didn't scare so easy. We were able to be all these things and do all these things because we were informed by great men, men who were revered. First step in solving any problem is recognizing there is one. America is not the greatest country in the world anymore.
Yes, so speaking about the greatest country in the world, we have a great person on the phone, Mr. Craig Maddens. Welcome
Hello.
To the show.
Thank you.
So we had a little technical problems with Skype in the beginning of the show, but we got it corrected.
Well, I tell you, I got to listen to the opening piece that you do for the show with Jeff Daniels making his pitch on America being the greatest country in the world. I don't know if you've had. Do you watch the show, The Newsroom?
Oh, absolutely.
I think it's one of the greatest shows to come along in a long, long time. It's absolutely fabulous, and I can't wait for this season because for those people that don't know, the girl who was who had asked that question and Jeff Daniels put her in her place. On the answer is going to be working for him because of said situation, and it came full cycle and full circle, and it truly shows that as an unbiased show that it's not Republican or Democrat, but that Republicans should fear the Tea Party as much as anybody else.
Well, absolutely. The Tea Party is just destroying the Republican Party, and for us to have, we will not have a good Democratic Party. We will not have a good Democratic Party unless we have a strong Republican Party. Right now, the Republicans sold out to the regressive wing of their party, a couple of little bitter peanut butter nothings who shouted loud enough and long enough like the Nazi Party did back in 1932 and took over their party. These people need to be purged from the Republican Party because they are doing damage to everybody, their own party and the Democratic Party, because their idea is to change everything. They want nothing to be the same, and they would rather destroy this country's democratic system just for their own self-interest.
Well, you know, it's interesting in the way you're phrasing that, that with fascism, with the Nazi Party's growth through Germany in the late 20s, early 30s, this ruling party, you know, basically kowtowed to that which started to grow within. It was the cancer that started to grow from within. And at this point, people don't think, realize that the Tea Party knocked out more of its own Republican electorate than it did the Democrats.
I mean, Richard Lugar, the strongest person in the Republican Party who knew more about foreign affairs than Mitt Romney will ever know if he lives to be 300 years old. They got rid of him because he said he liked Obama. Now, I mean, give me a break.
We've reached the point where if somebody has a good idea, if it's an R after his name or after her name, it doesn't matter. And if it's a Democrat, if it's a good idea from a person with a D after the name, it doesn't matter either. People are slowly starting to polarize, and to the extent that nothing matters except party origination and the strong overall doctrine of certain key individual people, and if you're in their way, you're going to get bulldozed out.
Well, you know, here's the thing, and I have somebody else holding that we need to talk about. I was having a long conversation with this gentleman who's on the other phone, but we'll get to you in just a minute, Bob. Anyway, the thing is that all the things that Obama has put forth since he's been a president, every single idea was approved by the Heritage Foundation and the Republican Party. He has nothing. There's not one single Democratic idea that he has put through since he's been president that's been Democratic. Not one. Approved by the Republican Party.
I know you're going to switch over to take that other call, but in closing...
I want you still on the air. I want you still on the air. Don't hang up. No, but I don't...
One of the reasons Romney will not put out his tax statement is the obvious part of how well he has done the last 4 years financially. I hazard to guess how much his portfolio has increased over the last 4 years during the Obama administration.
Obama administration, absolutely. My wife's portfolio went down almost 60% during the Bush years. 60%. And we said, gee, well, she's going to have to work another 5 years after before her regular retirement age. That thing has tripled now, or quadrupled. I mean, it's mind-boggling. But these people don't realize they have given the shaft, and you see, you know, what are you talking about? Goebbels, say it loud enough and long enough, and you'll get a third right on your side right away, because there are people out there. Yeah, I always remember the line from one of the lines from the fabulous film American President, where the president's aide says, you know, people need are thirsting for leadership so well that they're out in the, if they're out in the desert, they'll drink sand and drink water. And the president comes right back to him, they're drinking sand because they want to drink sand. I mean, this is where we're at today. And hold on a minute. Let me bring in Bob.
Okay.
Yes, sir, Mr. Lord.
Hey. You know, you could hold up your comments to the mirror, and that's just the way the Republicans feel about the Democrats. the division started with Obama saying to the Republicans when they were there for a meeting, saying, you lost, we won. And basically take your ideas and go shove them, because I'm not going to listen to you because I got the Senate and Congress. He didn't get anything through either one. His budget's been refused three times, 97 to nothing in the Senate when they put it through, when he had the Senate, the majority of the Senate, you know, the supermajority. So they got to get away from these things with the parties, because the Republicans are good. The Democrats, some of them, are good. I don't hold it against you, Mike. You're trying. And as far as my 401k went down too. But you know what killed the whole market, the whole bit, was the housing crisis. And that was Dodd and Franks. And Franks was having an affair with the head of Fannie Mae. And he went to Fannie Mae went to the banks and said, look, if you don't give out these loans, we're not going to give you any more money. So they gave out all these bad loans. When it hit Wall Street, they used to just put these loans through. And then finally they looked at it and said, these are no good. These are toxic. And it was when Wall Street started picking the loans they were going to put through that the whole market fell apart. And that was Dodd-Frank's, their deal, and what they wanted to have going through with everybody getting a mortgage. And it can't be done. You took me off the air, didn't you?
I got you on the air. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. I'm not on the, I couldn't get you on the computer.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Some Republican with computers.
You're calling on Skype.
Yeah, I just called in the regular number on the phone.
Well, that's it. That's the number. Yeah, you're heard live. Everybody's hearing you. Now, let me tell you. Can you hear?
Yeah, I'm here.
Look, never had a supermajority in the Senate. Never, ever, ever.
Filibuster. They had a filibuster-proof Senate, and they could have passed anything. It went through Congress, and it got to the Senate, and the Senate, nobody would vote for this thing because it was no good. Even the Democrats turned it down.
Hey, Bob, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me? Okay. If they had a filibuster-proof Senate in his first term, every single thing he wanted would have got through.
He had it. He did.
No,
he
no.
had it for the first 2 years.
No.
And he had the House, too. He had both of them.
He had the House. He always had the Senate, but he never had 60 in. He had 60 in the Senate until Kennedy died. And Kennedy died very shortly after he became president.
But they turned the budget down. He hasn't had a budget in 3.5 years, which is supposedly illegal. No.
Yes, they have.
Both the Senate and the House have voted down his budgets.
They have not. He has never even gotten to the Senate. He has.
Why didn't his budgets get to the Senate in the first 2 years? Why didn't they get there in the first 2 years? He had the majority. He had the majority in the House and the Senate.
The House did not approve it in his first 2 years. They never.
Who had the House?
Wait a minute. I remember.
The Democrats had the House.
Hold on, wait a minute. Let's go back to the first day. When he was putting his hand on the Bible, swearing in, 5 minutes after that, McConnell had a meeting, and he says, nothing gets passed. Nothing.
But he had the House. Everything could have gone through because the Democrats controlled the House and they controlled the Senate.
They control the House. You got to remember, even Republicans, well, they don't have it anymore, but you got to remember, there are blue dog Democrats in the House that are really Republicans. And that's the only way they control the House in the first 2 years, so they control. See, that's the reason why.
Why was it voted down 97 to nothing?
No, it was never voted down 97 nothing in the Senate. No, has never been voted down. No,
it was. It was voted down.
Okay. Yeah, unless they had a poison pill of methadone. That's the only reason why. All right, we can say this. The first 2 years.
Hey, Mike.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mike,
go ahead.
Why don't we bring this around to, this is exactly, I think, the point that the Fraternal Order of Police made. When they announced that they were not going to endorse Romney, they stated two things. One, his anti-union policies, of course. They said they couldn't endorse that because they were very worried about his what he had been promoting. But in a general sense, they said they were stepping out and not endorsing any of the candidates this time of the poisoned atmosphere that the partisanship had created, that it had weakened their faith in the entire political system in America. Now, that is the Fraternal Order of Police itself saying that, but that is reflective of what's happening with the entire citizenry of this country. Mm-hmm. Everybody's losing faith in the institutions because of what's going on, just like this fighting back and forth, endless fighting. You know, you didn't pass the budget, and you didn't vote for it, and I didn't do this, and they didn't do that, and it's just endless. So I think we ought to get back on track and move beyond that and be able to discuss things in a rational way and find solutions.
All right. Now, I have to correct myself. Bob is absolutely correct about the – I stand corrected, Mr. Lord. Bob, of the president's budget – was voted down 97-0, but you have to understand the contents of it. See, just saying it means nothing. I mean, I could say I have $5 million in my pocket. I didn't say how I got it. I just robbed over the First National outside. But see, the Senate voted unanimously to reject a $3.7 trillion budget plan that President Obama sent to Capitol Hill in February. 97 senators voted against a motion to take it up. They didn't want to take it up, okay? Democrat A said ahead of the vote that the Democratic caucus would not support the plan because it had been supplanted by the deficit reduction plan Obama outlined in a speech at Georgetown University in April. Republican leader Mitch McConnell demanded a vote on Obama's budget to show the Democrats don't support any detailed blueprint. McConnell said Obama's budget continued to be unsubstantial, okay? He noted during a floor speech Wednesday that Democrats initially employed the plan. The president's budget called for ending tax cuts for the wealthy and 3-year domestic spending freeze, saving an initial...
Let me just address one thing as far as, like, you know, for the wealthy. The wealthy that everybody's talking about is the very low percentage of people, right?
1%. The
1%. And they have $3.5 trillion. If you took all of their money, all of it, just take every dime that they have, that would only cover, you know, 3/5 of what Obama's run up in his first 3.5 years. That would be it. And you couldn't go back and get them again. So, like, really, how much money? I've never heard when they talk about taxing the rich and their fair share. I've never heard a figure. You know? What do they want to go to? How much tax do you want to take? Right now they pay 64% of all taxes in the United States. How much tax do you want to take from them?
All right, let me check it. The president's budget called for ending tax cuts for the wealthy and a 3-year domestic spending freeze.
How much tax do you want to take from them, though? What tax rate do you want to put them at?
39%. The same thing that they had under Bill Clinton. Don't tell me you were starving under Bill Clinton. Nobody was starving under Bill Clinton.
Nobody was what?
Just like they said.
Bill Clinton, though, he came around after he lost, had that huge backlash, and he lost the House and the Senate. That's when he came back into line. And
it was 39%. That's what
I know.
Who are you talking to?
Mike, I'm on the radio.
Oh, God.
So that was when he came around. Carl just came in. That's when he came around to being more centric.
No.
And that's when the economy took off like crazy. And that's why he got elected again for the second term, because everybody was doing well because of the Republican House and Senate.
They were doing well at 39%. they would say, you can't duck the issue. It was 39%. The 1%ers and 2%ers were paying. Not, as a matter of fact, I think it was up to 5%.
I'd go for that. Yeah, I'd go for that, and I think most people would go for that. The problem, though, is for the first 2 years when he had the House and the Senate, he didn't put one job bill up. He didn't do anything for jobs. He didn't even talk about jobs. He did nothing, and we were at over almost 9% unemployment. He did nothing to foster employment and to do any kind of employment.
Let me finish reading this, okay? The president's budget called for an ending tax cut for the wealthy and a three-year domestic spending freeze, saving an estimated $1.1 trillion over 10 years. Democratic senators in time called it an important step forward, a good start. No Democratic senator was willing to support it, however, after Obama discussed a more ambitious plan at the Georgetown University to save $4 trillion over 12 years. Republicans criticized the speech for lacking detail. The White House of Management and Budget declined to comment on it. Now, okay, the Senate also rejected a House passed budget sponsored by Representative Paul Ryan, which failed 40-57. Now, the thing is that we need to know that they do not, when every one of these moo-moos got up on their daggone debate, every one of them said that they would not okay a plan that gave 10 times more spending cuts than taxes. Now, if you're in that shape, you can't get nothing passed.
You just said that Obama's budget went in, and the Democrats rejected it because it had too much spending in it. That's what the Democrats did.
No, it did not have too much spending. There was too much. They were going to cut. He was going to cut too much out of the budget. He was saving $4 trillion over 12 years instead of $1.1 trillion. They thought it was too much.
Is that before the $5.25 billion? Or $5.4 trillion now? That he spent or after?
Well, wait a minute. That 5.5 trillion is also included the two wars that Mr. Bush started, and the $875 billion tax cut he gave for Medicare D. So if you can get rid of all of them, he ain't spent jack. I've spent more than him. Listen,
I can believe that you spent more than he did, Mike. I can believe it. But you know, the other thing, you know, the other guy mentioned unions and all, and you and I went through this when we worked on Wall Street. And do any of your listeners know that you work on Wall Street?
Probably not. I haven't gotten to it yet.
They do now, right? The thing that what we're going through then, Nixon put through a freeze on pay increases. And all of us figured, well, that'd be good because the unions, which has come out that people have seen, have caused a spiral in inflation. When they were going to freeze them, that was good. Then it came out, you can't freeze them because they're contractual workers. And if you look at what happened with the unions, they're weaker now.
I have somebody else that also wants to come in there. Mr. Marshall, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Are you actually here, gentlemen, Mr. Robert Ford from Connecticut, who is a wealthy rancher with Ford?
I'm broke, Mike. I'm broke. Come up and stay in my house for me.
All the money in the Cayman Islands. We used to walk on Wall Street. And that's where the money's buried.
Mike, you have a better phone?
Are you there? Hey, have you heard what Mr. Lord has said about the money?
Somewhat.
Somewhat. Well, he has money in the Cayman Islands. See?
Oh, he has money in the Cayman Islands. How much does he have out there?
I don't have anything in the Cayman Islands, but remember that, what's her name, Debbie Schultz? She's got money in the Cayman Islands, too. Romney is paid, I'm sure Debbie Schultz is paid, all the taxes on it. That happens to be where their some of their investments are. And as far as a portfolio, all of us want our portfolios to go up.
Listen, I am saying that I have money in the Cayman Islands, but Mr. Romney is saying...
Mike, how much money do you have in the Cayman Islands?
Oh, I can't say because I don't want my wife to know.
Oh, okay.
And she's working.
Okay. And she has to listen to the show, right?
She's working.
But like you... During the Obama years.
Did it go down
during the Bush?
It went down like 60% during the Bush years.
Mike, I'm losing you, so I'm going to call you back on another line.
Okay.
I wish I was where he was. I heard motorcycles in the background.
He's going to get another call.
He's at the rally with the Outlaws.
Yeah, at the Outlaw
rally. Where's that? Where's your rally?
Yeah, I have no idea. That's in Wake County somewhere. But anyway, let me tell you. If they ever ask me, am I better off today than I was 4 years ago, damn right.
Yeah.
Absolutely, without a doubt. Absolutely, without a doubt. And anybody says that they're not better off today than they were 4 years ago. Now, there are some people who are still worse off.
23 million people are unemployed. They're better off? We've never had such a horrible situation.
You know why? See, you got to remember.
We've never had an economy off the cliff
before. We never had an economy go off the cliff until 1931, 1932. You got to remember.
Yeah, but you got to remember, Mike, the reason we drove off that cliff was the first thing that went was the housing market. And the housing market went, and Wall Street was initially involved in it because they take the loans, they bundle them, and they give them to investors. And then they pulled the plug on sending them out there because I was in real estate at the time. And there were so many toxic loans going out. There were so many people that were looking for loans that were so bad that they couldn't even get them. But they were all brought to the table saying, you can get this loan. You deserve a loan. You can get it. I talked to one guy, and he was going to have his unemployment pay for his house. You know?
Yeah, but under whose presidency was that? That was George Bush. That wasn't under Bill. That wasn't under Barack Obama.
But Bush and McCain went to Congress, and they didn't do it strongly enough. It was weak. But they said, we can't do this. We can't go on like this. We're going to have a problem.
Yeah.
Well, check that. You can check me on that. And they kept on doing it because it was stupid. I'm not saying that Bush didn't spend a load of money.
Wait a minute. That's an understatement. Look, let me explain something to you. Before the housing thing went off the cliff, Bush went into Iraq. He went into Afghanistan. Then he went into Iraq and did not pay for it, did not have anything to pay for it. And then besides that, he had the Medicare B and didn't pay for that. We were going down off the cliff anyway before the housing started. Now, you got
already burned through the $6 trillion surplus.
That's right. You got to remember.
There was no $6 million surplus.
You kidding me?
There was no $6 trillion surplus. The surplus was in a deficit. It wasn't in we always had a deficit. We've had a deficit going back into the 70s.
Deficit, as Dick Cheney said, mean nothing. Mean nothing.
A debt. The deficit, the thing that they keep on talking about a surplus, is the deficit, how much money comes into the Treasury versus going out of the Treasury. We did have a surplus. Now they're saying that maybe we didn't have a surplus, but it wasn't in the Treasury. We were in debt going way back. We've never had a surplus in the Treasury since, I don't know, 50 years, 30 years, whatever it's been.
You got to remember.
Well, yeah, no, listen. There is a problem with the deficit and with vacuuming out our treasury. But I do distinctly remember that we went through the largest, greatest boom in the history of the world from the World War II forward because of why? We actually had a tax system.
Absolutely.
We taxed corporations.
Now,
but, we taxed everyone fairly.
That's right.
And
now,
it only ended in when? What was that, 1980?
Let me read you, do the fact check for you.
Now, the 80s, we were in we were hurting as far as jobs and everything else. The early 80s were really bad.
Right.
Mills were closing down the whole nine yards. Oh, and they talk about that steel mill. When I was working for a company that manufactured bearings for steel, steel was in dire straits and closing up all over the place. And that one steel mill that they pumped $8 million or $800 million into to try to save, and it didn't work, was a sign of the times. We were selling bearings to companies that manufactured steel mills in Korea. There were a lot of them were backup bearings for cold rolling steel, which does the fronts of refrigerators and stuff like that. There's nothing going on here. When I went in the steel mills in Canada, I went into one called the Fasco that had holes in the side of it. They were doing well, but they had holes in the side of the building where high school kids used to walk through as, on a shortcut to and from school. It wasn't like the other places. All these other places were able to rebuild and had money pumping in, a lot of it American money. But that steel mill was probably going to go out anyway. It had nothing to do with Romney.
Romney?
Yeah, well, Mitt Romney with that steel mill that everybody talks about, the GS or whatever it is, steel. That is, the guy's wife died because Romney closed the steel mill, and it turns out that his wife was working and she had her own health care, and that not only that, but she didn't get cancer for like 5 years after the mill closed. That one.
I might agree with 90% of what you just said, but let me read you something here. During the Bill Clinton years was the federal budget balanced. Fact check.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was the Republican Congress, the Republican House and Senate. But he did. Clinton did come with a balanced budget and present it. And, yes, that did happen.
Was the federal deficit erased? Yes. And this happened not when the Republicans took over, but the first year Bill Clinton's of his fiscal year when he was now his budget in 1994.
But that's the deficit. Don't confuse the deficit with the debt.
I'm not saying it was the federal, yes, the deficit and the federal budget were both balanced.
Yeah. The deficit is, as you know, I'm sure, the deficit is the amount of money coming in versus the amount of money coming out, coming into the treasury, going out. And they balanced the budget where it should be anything from negative to even. The debt is what we've accumulated, and for years we are spending more money than we're taking in. That's the deficit. And with that money that builds up the debt because we're borrowing 42 cents of everything that we spend.
All right, let me read again. During Bill Clinton's administration, was the federal budget balanced? Was the federal deficit erased? Yes to both questions.
Not the debt, though. The deficit.
The debt means nothing. If it wasn't for debt, the Bain Capital would not have a job.
The debt is $16 trillion. It does mean something.
No, it doesn't. Does the debt mean anything? Mitt Romney would be a pauper. Mitt Romney, you know as well as I do, if you look at Gordon Gekko, everything he said was true. We create debt. We are people who go in to create debt to make money. They go to companies that have great pension plans and money in programs, and they go into those companies that need help otherwise besides the debt.
Oh, yeah, that's the whole thing. They started Staples, or they gave the money for Staples to get started. They were an investment group, and, of course, that's where your stocks and all your money is in the Cayman Islands and all. You invest money that people need, so they do have a debt, or they have to grow with the debt and can't get loans. And that's what Bain Capital would do. They were a fostering company. They were a company that would put money in to develop companies and have them grow. And from that, they would get payback.
Now, David, that's what they say. They are corporate raiders.
That's what they do. They're not corporate raiders. They're developers. A corporate raider was like a company that owned Fafner here in Connecticut that came in, and they didn't invest any money at all. They just took money out.
All right, tell me between Bain Capital and Gordon Gekko in the movie Wall Street. What's the difference?
I don't know Gekko at all. You're talking about the guy that does the commercials for Geico Insurance?
Stop it. You don't want the movie. What is the difference between Gordon Gekko and Bain Capital? I'll tell you, zero.
I don't know. What's Gordon Gekko, though? I don't know Gordon Gekko.
Was the part that Michael Douglas played in Wall Street.
In Wall Street? I didn't see Wall Street.
Oh, no. Academy Award winning film. He won the Academy Award for it. He was Mitt Romney back in the 80s.
That Bain Capital was not a corporate raider. That wasn't. He gave out seed money. He gave seed money to the guy that started Staples. He wasn't a corporate raider. He didn't come in and build the thing up and tear it down. He put $100 million into that steel mill, that GS Steel, and finally it couldn't go because the steel mills in the States don't go anywhere. They're doing nothing.
Okay, let me say something. Bain Capital never used one single dime of their own money for anything. Never. Never, ever, 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 ever. They went to a company that had riches in their pension funds and took that money out and then borrowed against that money. That's how. They never used a dime of their own money.
Well, wait. If you go to a company and you do that, the company could have done that themselves. So I don't believe that that's true. And you talk about pensions. When Obama went to GM and Ford, and I heard, Chrysler, not Ford, that one of his people was saying how they saved Ford in the whole bit. They had nothing to do with Ford. But when he went there, do you know that he paid off the unions and he cut the pension, totally removed the pension from companies that had GM companies that were not unionized. Delphi was one of them. It was like 200,000 people that lost their pension because they weren't union. This guy is a total union pawn, puppet, whatever you want to call him. It's what if the unions want it, the unions get it.
Are you telling me Obama negotiated this himself?
His people, Geithner was the one that did it, but Geithner works for Obama.
Who did it?
Huh?
Geithner did.
Check that out. I think it was Delphi that lost their pensions because they were not unionized.
Why weren't they unionized?
Hey, man, that's
Who wants to be unionized? I don't want to be unionized.
Well, hey, so you say, wait a minute. You said they lost their pension because they weren't unionized. So you've made a good reason to get unionized.
No, this is Obama's way of thinking. It was Obama that did this. He protected the unions and he destroyed these people that weren't unionized.
Delphi, who?
Delphi, it's a division of GM. I think they make the electronics and stuff.
And
I think technically the economy was destroyed, and then Obama unfortunately came in at that moment and had to save what he could save. And he tried to do so, and has even been lambasted since that he couldn't save everyone and make everybody a millionaire. But
absolutely,
I think he's done good, horrible, and he inherited.
Well, the one of the problems I have, Greg, right? Is it Greg or Craig?
Thomas.
What is it? I'm sorry.
Thomas.
No, this is Thomas.
Thomas. I can't hear. It's breaking up. But a lot of people felt that the auto industry should have gone into bankruptcy so they could renegotiate the union contracts. Obama came in And as Romney's saying, they did do exactly what Romney wanted them to do, but they took so long and it cost so much money that $20 billion more was spent on doing it.
Okay.
But they didn't renegotiate the union contracts. You know, some of these unions, they can retire at 50 years old with full pension.
Okay.
You know,
well,
some of the municipal unions and stuff.
The pension benefits of Delphi.
Yeah.
It was in the court papers that companies and pension administrators miscalculated the pension benefits, misinterpreting pension plans and improperly amending pension plans. And the suit is, if you are a participant in a pension plan and believe that your pension plan or estimated pension plan payment is incorrect, you need to be part of this lawsuit. So it had nothing to do with Obama. The pension people of Delphi are the ones that screwed this up.
No, because in all of that, what they did with Obama coming in and putting this thing through, that's how they didn't protect them at all, and that's how the things got screwed up. And they backed the unions. The unions got 10% of the company. The bondholders of the company got zero. And in a bankruptcy, the first ones that get paid are the bondholders because they don't own anything in the company. What they did was invest. It would be like an investor putting money into a company. They're the first ones to get paid off. And he dumped every one of them and gave 10% to the union.
Russ Limbaugh would say, I'm reading a national plaintiff's class action suit against them.
When was it dated?
When was it dated? It was dated, let me go back here.
Let's see if it says this one. When is this dated? Let's see if I can get back to it.
Well, here's the question.
Can't get back to it. Oh, hold on. Let me look up here again. I can't. Cohen and Milston is the group. Maybe about malpractices prevention. I can't see. I can't get back. Let me get back here. But this is down at the bottom here. No, does it say? It's got a call number. But this is I
have all the things that's in the plaintiff's class action suit. And it has nothing. They don't bring in the federal government in this at all. They're saying the main problem was how the pension benefits were miscalculated by the people. And this is the workers' plaintiff. This is the workers' case against the firm.
You got it. Yeah, you got to investigate it more, though, Mike. And I don't want to hog the whole show, but investigate that more, because everything that I've heard was that when they did this, the pensioners from Delphi lost their pension, and it was due to the takeover of GM.
Nope. Has nothing to do with it. They don't mention GM down here at all. And
yep,
I'm looking at
the current company is.
Hack or deferred convention of pension plans, ESO transactions, pension benefits. These are all that's in their action against them. Termination of disability, employees, elimination of retirement benefits, and none of this.
Well, let me ask you another question then.
Okay.
We have all the problems overseas, and it's not due to the film, because everybody's saying this thing was totally orchestrated and all, and it was set off on 9/11, and now they're screaming now that there's 1.5 billion Osama bin Ladens out to get you and all of that other stuff. Why were the Marines, and why weren't they all of the security beefed up when 9/11 was coming?
Well,
the Marines, what I'm hearing is the Marines had guns, but they weren't allowed to load them.
Well, yeah.
I think that was Lebanon.
When the 280.
Oh, that's now. They're talking about now. They're talking about now that the Marines had weapons, but they were not able to load them, and they were undermanned at these bases.
But I heard that from that dittohead Rush Limbaugh, the coward, never has served in this man's
life. I told you I don't listen to Rush Limbaugh.
Sean Hannity, I can say for a whole lot. Hannity, O'Reilly, or. Hey, you name it.
I listen to them, and very fair and balanced. Oh, Hannity's not. He's not fair and balanced. But I also listen to the Ed Show just to get the other side, and he's a wacko. He's so far out in left field that, well, left field is where he belongs, right? The Ed Show on CNN or whatever he's on.
No, he's on MSNBC.
Okay. See, Mike, you got to remember, I'm sitting here with a flaming liberal.
So that's what I'm saying. So, you know, you have to watch tonight because I have to.
I got Carla here. I have to watch all these other shows.
Yeah, you also have to watch tonight while you're leaving because I just ordered some taste-free arsenic.
The what?
Taste-free arsenic.
Taste-free arsenic.
Free.
Wait, you're breaking up. What did you say, tape-free?
It goes in your meal.
What am I supposed to do, though? Or are you saying I got to record something?
No.
What did you say?
I said that you have to watch out because she has ordered some taste.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I know. My arsenic level is going up drastically, and every time I say it to Carla, she smiles.
Yeah, well, a little bit. Maybe another couple of years.
That's
Cary
Grant
pants, right? Yes, that's right. Arsenic and Old Lace, you saw that movie, right?
Yes.
Anyway, listen, Mr. Marshall, are you back with us?
I'm back with you. And I was listening to make reference to the embassy. All of our embassies carry probably less than a squad of Marines all over the world, and particularly those in the Near East, because we don't want to seem like we are carrying
I understand that, Mr. Marshall. I understand that, except for one thing. We lost four people at one embassy, and is it more important to protect the other people's feelings or our people? And I think with what Obama comes out with, I think it's more important for him to protect the Muslims' feeling than it is to protect our people. And it's a horrible thing to say, but that's really what's coming out of this.
That's not the job of the embassy. The job to protect the embassy is by the country that you're in.
And if the country isn't, he should have been out there demanding that they were, or pulled our people out, or put people in to say, hey, you guys can't protect them, we're going to protect them. And he didn't do it. And four of our people, including the embassy ambassador, was killed.
Well, I believe that was a planned assassination.
Oh, I agree with you. I agree 100%.
It was a planned assassination, and now if you want to go out blaming something, you need to blame our intelligence people. They were the one primarily responsible for making sure that our people are protected, no matter what.
Why, Mr. Marshall, why are we apologizing to them?
I don't think the president apologized. I think he was making a point.
You can't show me that in one piece of paper.
An apology is when you say I'm sorry for such and such happening. And
right. Well, they basically were when they were saying that we don't stand behind us, we have no control over what our people do. That's basically stepping back and saying, hey, you know, I understand.
Well,
we're not behind this. We're not for it. So that is an apology. That is saying to them, we had nothing to do with this, and we're kind of sorry for it happening.
Are we talking about the movie itself?
No, not the movie. No, I don't think the movie had anything to do with it. Oh, yeah, I am talking about the movie because that's what Secretary of State said. On how we had nothing to do with it and this and that and everything else, so we can't control our people and this thing. And basically, that's an apology.
Well, listen, hold on.
The Secretary of State never said that.
Listen, the Secretary of State did.
So. She said that we can't control our people with what they put out and et cetera, et cetera.
When did she say that?
I don't know if it was last night or this morning she was on.
Not what she said.
I haven't heard her say that.
Yeah.
We just watched
this morning. She was saying that we can't control our people and we're disgusted by this movie, et cetera, et cetera.
Not what she said. What
yes,
she
it
said.
Is. It is. Google her. Pull her up on Google or whatever, and that is what she said. And it was like either last night or this morning. Cause I saw it again this morning, or saw it this morning.
And that was on CNN?
I think it was on everything.
Now, listen, let me explain something. That's not what she said. What she said was, this is a democratic society, and we do not control what people say.
Yes.
That's what she said.
Exactly. And that is basically an apology. Instead of coming out and saying, look, you guys killed our people, and we're not going to stand for it. She didn't say anything about them. It was more that, hey, we can kind of understand why you're doing this, because you saw a movie, and it has nothing to do with the movie. This was a planned attack, and we did nothing to protect our people.
Okay. Let me explain something to you. All right. If you're going to talk about apologies, which you shouldn't have got on, because I have in front of me the five apologies that Mr. George Bush made to the Arab countries. The five. Okay? He apologized, and see, he apologized, not the Secretary of State. He apologized.
What did he apologize? Oh, yes, he apologized when we went out and we killed, whatever we did. He apologized to overt acts against basically their people and humanity, something that we wouldn't do, something that was terrible, but not because of how our laws are or how we live.
What
totally different. Totally different, Mike. Totally different. He apologized because of, was it Abu Ghraib or whatever it was, for those guys that shot civilians. That is totally different from apologizing because of the way we live and how our Constitution set up.
He totally was also apologized for the cartoons that offended the Muslims. You remember that? Remember the cartoon that was published?
Yeah, and to me that was wrong that he did that. Definitely wrong. You know?
So he did it. I don't remember them saying, let's get him out of office because he apologized. They didn't make no big deal about that. And, you know, the second time, he also apologized about the anti-Semitic readings that were done. This anti-Muslim images that are unacceptable and anti-Semitic, which are routinely published in the Arab press.
Yes, I could see that, too. But four of our people weren't killed.
Okay.
They weren't killed. They weren't attacked. Our embassy wasn't burnt to the ground, and our people threatened, and then go out and apologize. This is an overt act by someone that was supposed to be an ally. Well, not according to Obama. They're not allies. But this is somebody that came out after our people, put them in danger, burnt the embassies. There are two other ones now that have gone down, at least that I've heard about. And not drawing that you can say, hey, yeah, that shouldn't be, we're not behind that, we don't agree with it, et cetera, and that is terrible. It's different when all of a sudden you've been attacked and you're killing our people to go out and say, you know, I understand where you're coming from. We should have dug our heels in and been very forceful
on
how this will not be taken, we will not put up with it, and not, you know, but they didn't.
It's still a bomb. Let's go bomb him.
He has now bombed.
Carla's saying that he has now.
He spoke to them.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, he did speak to them, and they started pulling their people back. But one of the reasons I think they pulled their people back is because everybody's saying now, hey, they were supposed to get $2 billion or more. Let's not give it to them. So they want the money.
You know that's not going to happen.
What? We'll give them the money and they'll give half of it to Al-Qaeda.
But does it matter? Listen, you got to remember that these are the people that all the Republicans wanted the President of the United States to support during this big uprising. You got to remember that. They said he ain't going in there sooner. He needs to help these people. So now, if he didn't help these people, maybe we would not have been in this situation. But the Republicans wanted it. So now, since it's gone negative, now you're going to blame Obama. You can't have both sides of it.
No. I'm not blaming anybody. Mubarak, he's like any dictator. At least we knew who we were. We should have learned our lesson no matter what side of it's on. When we got rid of the Shah of Iran in 78, 79, that you be careful. Okay. It's the old thing. Be careful what you wish for. And you look at the disaster that turned into. And we should learn our lesson. We seem to constantly preach history repeats itself, and then we're surprised when it does.
That's right.
What I'm upset with is that they weren't reinforced, and they weren't, and then they apologized for it.
Nobody has apologized. Give me the sentence where they have apologized.
What you just read, what Clinton said, was an apology. Was basically an apology. Nothing about how the hell do you think you can kill our people, and we're not going to do something about it.
I think you all are not. You have not given the president credit for what has happened. He's not going to go out until his intelligence folks have actually examined the situation and determine what actions should be taken.
Obama's already acted. Okay, from moment one, he never apologized for anything. He said first and foremost that justice would be done.
Right.
That cannot escape. They cannot get away. And
right.
From the experts that were on the other day that I listened to, they said they already know who did it.
That's right.
They already are tracking them down now, and you know they're going to be taken out. Now, what he's giving the one chance to do is these countries to redeem themselves and do it themselves.
Right.
And if they, then we'll take them out. So that's already in operation. Two.
It's already in operation.
Yep. He already deployed Marines to the embassy.
And there are two warships.
But on these, he's already deployed on the ground. So, I mean, I don't understand this whole fiction
because
of he's apologizing.
It's fiction.
It's fiction. It's a figment of his imagination.
No. They should have come out a lot stronger than this, and before all of this, because 9/11 was coming, and it was just.
What would you have done if you were in the situation that our president is in? What would you have done?
Well, I would have hoped that I would have beefed up all of the embassies, especially the ones that are in a dangerous area, and had the Marines with, loaded rifles and the whole bit, and then have talked with all of. Whether I had to go there or the Secretary of State had to go there, whatever, going over and said, look, we're coming up to a very fearful time, 9/11, Bin Laden was just killed recently, May, whatever it was it March or May, was just killed. We want to make sure that all of our places are protected, that you're going to stand behind them, and if you don't, then we're going to be really on the edge. And they didn't do that. And they should have done that.
So far enough. We're really going to do what?
They should have talked to Massari and explained to them that we were concerned, and were they going to protect these and make sure that there was no damage, no destruction, no attack, and if not, we're going to pull our people out because we can't take the chance because of 9/11. And they didn't do any of it. They went on as though it was just a regular day on the calendar and didn't protect any of these people.
So you don't know that. You do not know that.
No, he does not know that.
Egypt did not do anything. If they had done that, they would be out there now saying, look, we went to these governments. We said to them that this what we need to do is this, and it didn't happen. But they're not saying that because they didn't do it.
Okay. Listen.
You're saying
we got 5 more minutes because I got 2 other calls here.
Okay, but he said.
Yeah.
You're saying that Obama, if he went to all these places and didn't get them to do whatever he wanted, that he should suck tail and run, and we should pull out of all these countries worldwide?
No, because if they could not guarantee their protection, they should have pulled them out for 9/11. They could put them back in again, but pull them out during the most dangerous time. If they can't guarantee that these people were going to be protected, and believe me, I think that, Egypt or whatever, I think that, it was like a grassroots thing, and that they could probably have talked to the guy and said something that would have possibly made the difference. But the thing is, whether it did or whether it would have or not, they didn't do that, and they should have.
whistleblower. That's why Obama is president and you are not, and Romney will never be president, because that's not the way you do what we call foreign affairs or diplomacy.
You don't talk to other people that you think are going to cause a problem, Mike?
You know, he did not talk to them. You don't know.
We didn't.
And why should he tell me? How do you know he did not speak to them?
Because if you had talked to them, they would be saying now, look, we went to these countries. We asked for their protection. We were assured we were going to get it. Obviously, they could not give it to us. But they're not saying that now. They will probably tomorrow, because the thought will go to them and say, yeah, we went over there. But they didn't do that. They didn't talk to the countries and say, look, we're in a bad position now, and we're concerned because 9/11 is coming up and Bin Laden was just killed, you know, 5 months ago, whatever it was.
That's what a cops person would think that, but that's not how diplomacy works. That's not how – you don't tell everybody every single thing you're doing. That's not – how it works. And hold on. I got two other calls here that I have to take. So if you want to stop, Bob, you can stick around. I need to take these other calls.
Go ahead. I'll talk to you later. I'll give you a call later on.
Right. Hello there. Who's this?
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I was – I guess he got off the line, but I was going to say, I mean, the guy that just got off the line, man, he's – I mean, it seemed like he could have found a more informed, I don't know, Republican or conservative. He's not even really making good sense, man. I mean, it don't even take, you know, more than one person to debunk almost everything he's saying.
Of course, you know, the
very true. Debunk it.
Well, I'll give you one. Just the last statement about, hey, he should have went in and talked to them 5 months ago and said the Bin Laden thing is coming up. Well, if anybody... Last time I checked, man, this is, 10 years ago? Why didn't you make that argument the first year?
Ben Laden was killed five months ago.
Huh? Yeah.
This is the first 9/11 after Bin Laden was killed. And the Arabs are running around. Are you still there, Mike?
Yep, I'm here.
Yeah, the Arabs are running around saying, we have 1.5 billion Bin Ladens. This is a reaction to Bin Laden being shot and against the United States. And we should have been more prepared, knowing that that is coming up, 9/11 is coming up, and we should have been prepared or talked to the other countries and said, look, can you protect our people or not? And if they said, we can't guarantee it, we should have gotten our people out.
Yes.
Listen, that's not necessary. They have also attacked the German embassy. And which they're not Americans. Why would they attack the Germans?
It's almost like it's Monday.
Attacking all Westerners, but it's all because it goes back to the hatred for the West. It doesn't matter who else they're attacking. Does that just, well, gee, they're attacking the Germans, so our four people that were killed, what's the big deal?
No.
That doesn't make any sense.
No.
Well, I think no matter what anybody else say, you have your own opinion and we have our own opinion. I think it's going to end this way. As a stalemate, so there's nothing we can do to change your mind, and there's nothing you won't ever do.
I'd say
some
one thing that you agree with. Yeah. This isn't a tough world, you know, because no matter what our differences are, when it really comes down to it, we don't want any of this. We might debate whether it, you know, how to do it differently or whatever else, but it's really tough. And I give a lot of credit to the service people and, you know, our ambassadors and all the rest of it. And I think we all agree with that. We might argue over the mechanics, but the rest of it, we're all on the same side.
Bob, let me finish up also. When the Arab Spring came about, in all these countries, we knew this was a possibility of happening. You got to remember, these people have almost been enslaved their entire life.
But they don't even know it, Mike. They don't even know it. You know, like Clinton was saying, that they don't even have a clue as to how we work and how, you know, the government doesn't control every movement where it does with them, you know?
Okay, let me finish. Well, what I'm saying is, none of the people who were protesting in front of these embassies were the people that started these fires. It was a small group of fanatic terrorists who saw an opportunity to go into the crowd. So these peaceful demonstration at most. None of the people in Libya or in Cairo or in other places were the ones that were causing all this devastation burning. It was the terrorist groups that got in with this group that got in. So you got to remember that we're always going to have terrorists. And you don't see if what you're saying is we should have sent Marines in there. What happens if the if England says, you know what, I need to send 1,000 Marines over to guard our embassy in New York City? What would you say? You can't do it. It's not going to be done. What happens is that we give them how many people are going to be there. There are no more and no less. And the Marines there, or every embassy has some Marines. They don't have a battalion of Marines. They got maybe 20, maybe, at most, not even that many.
No,
so every outpost is a fitting duck unless the host country protects that outpost.
I mean, it's almost like this guy saying, hey, man, you didn't get the ships over there quick enough. I mean,
right.
Agreed.
Right.
What do
you know, there's just certain things that we can do and there's certain things that we can't do. One of the things is don't put an invasion force in our embassies.
I didn't say an invasion force.
Well, hey.
Not an invasion force. But if we couldn't, Mike, come on. If we couldn't protect them, they shouldn't have been there. Really, they should have gotten them out. And who knows? You can't read ahead of what's going to happen all the time. But something like this, they got it on TV now with them burning the flag. I heard on CNN they were saying that one of these weren't the same people that were the Arab Spring. These were less intelligent people that were involved in it and all this other stuff. But who knows? And they'll sort that part of it out. All I was saying was, like, if we couldn't protect them, you don't expect Marines to protect the place when you have so few of them and you don't let them load their guns. But if you can't, get them out. But you get them out.
Where did you see that they can't load their guns? Where have you seen that? I have not seen that and not heard that.
I think it was CNN they were talking, but it's all speculation as far as, whose it is and whose it's not and stuff.
The point is that right now I need to go to another call. That's what the point is, and I need to take this.
Mike, take care. I'll give you a call later. I'll talk to you later.
All right.
Bye.
And the gentleman I have on the phone right now. What's your name? What's your first name?
Yeah, Maurice.
Maurice?
Yeah.
Listen. All right. Now, what you were saying is absolutely true, Maurice. And I'd like you to stay on if you can for a minute.
Okay.
Okay. Good. Hello, who's this?
Hello?
Yes.
This is John Brooks, candidate for Commission of Labor.
John, I am glad you waited. We had a lively discussion here about what was going on. As a matter of fact, we went over. ladies and gentlemen, this is John Brooks, who was the former Commissioner of Labor a few years back, and he is running for the Democratic Party in North Carolina as the Commissioner of Labor. John,
and I'm delighted to be with you this afternoon. I think it's very important that we have a change in the Commissioner of Labor's post.
You and me both, and I think everybody else. I don't want to see. I want that. First of all, if you become commissioner, will you take that picture down out of the elevator?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I've told a lot of people that I think it's inappropriate to have a picture in an elevator. This commissioner, Cherie Berry, is the first commissioner to ever have a picture in the elevator. I don't think it's appropriate, and I would not have a picture in the elevator.
Well, what is something that you know that needs to be very desperately as far as the Commissioner of Labor is concerned?
In North Carolina, we have over 60,000 workplace claims at the Industrial Commission that's in the Department of Commerce every year. That's way, way, way too many work-related injuries and illnesses in North Carolina. And I think I'm in a position to focus the OSHA activities, education, consultation, and enforcement on significantly reducing the workplace injuries in North Carolina and the seriousness of those injuries.
Have you... You've been involved with OSHA before when you were the Commissioner of Labor in the past. Is that correct?
That's correct, and it was always underfunded. It's a program that is 50% federally funded and 50% state funded, and the difficulty is that the fiscal years, you know, are different. The state fiscal year starts July 1st. The federal fiscal year starts October 1st, and the state has a law that says you can't spend any state money that is not matched by the federal government in this program. And the federal government, similarly, has a program that says you can't spend any federal money that isn't matched by state money. And so you have to juggle your budget requests and appropriations to try to maximize getting the two amounts even. I generally, when I was commissioner before, had more state money than I had federal money. The program, though, has been underfunded at the federal level as well as the state level from the very beginning back in 1972.
Mm-hmm. Now, the state money, my understanding is that this regressive party that's in right now has really cut back on state funding for everything. So that has really killed what you would be doing as the Commissioner of Labor.
Well, that's right. The Department of Labor has been overall underfunded all these years, and this last legislature cut the Department of Labor another $650,000. That doesn't sound like much, but when it's matched by federal dollars, it makes a significant impact on the department. And right now, if we had no new businesses in North Carolina for the next 50 years, the OSHA division enforcement staff would take 50 years to inspect each business for which it has jurisdiction one time during the next 50 years. That's totally unacceptable.
Well, we have more than 4.5 million workers, too, across the state, right?
That's right. And of course, in the last 20 years, we've had a significant increase in the number of people in North Carolina and the number of employers and the number of employees. So actually, the program has been shrinking just by attrition in terms of inflation and the growth of the state.
Well, what are some of the things that the department oversees in the workplace safety area?
The department oversees mines and quarries, amusement devices. In fact, every time an amusement device is taken down and set up in North Carolina, it has to be reinspected, whether it's at a state fair or shopping center or whatever. All the amusement rides are inspected at the state fair and the other fairs around North Carolina. The department also administers the wage and the Wage Act of North Carolina, wage and hour. It needs prompt attention to complaints that are filed there. I get a lot of feedback from people saying that there's a great delay before their follow-up inspections. The department also administers the apprenticeship program in North Carolina. That's a federal program that's administered at the state level. On-the-job training, it authorizes and certifies the programs. There's a requirement that there be 144 hours of related instruction for each year of instruction. Generally, the apprenticeship programs run about 4 years. So part of the task of the Department of Labor is to be sure there is quality-related instruction. But again, that program suffers in that right now it has about a 17% completion rate of the apprentices in North Carolina. And again, that's not acceptable. But those are some of the
if they have a 17% completion rate, so high on the agenda should be the expansion of a high-tech vocational education, right?
That's right. In fact, North Carolina needs to greatly expand its technical training offerings, both through the community colleges and beyond. The community college is a two-year program. A lot of the technical training that's required to be a certified craft person are four-year programs. So we need to add to North Carolina. We need to go a step further than we have gone thus far. and put in place what I call an Academy for Advanced Technical Training that would be an engine pulling the community college system and using modern technology to telecommunicate from a central center academy to the community colleges, quality courses in a lot of areas where now there's no curriculum available. And the reason for having a central location is because with our community colleges covering the state as they do, generally they don't have the faculty and they don't have the resources to offer the kind of technical training that's needed, particularly if the classes are only a dozen or so students. To make it economical and to have quality instruction, we need to be able to telecommunicate courses from a central location with a quality faculty to any of the community college where there are students who want to participate in a particular course or career. Right now, North Carolina offers one or another course in 57 of the 650 careers, technical careers defined by the U.S. Department of Labor. So there are almost 600 other career crafts for which there's no training in North Carolina at the present time. And the reason that's so important is that right now there are over 600,000 vacant jobs in the United States for skilled workers where there are no applicants who are qualified. The result of that is that the President of the United States has essentially waived the quota requirements for immigrants anywhere in the world for people who can come to the United States and qualify for any of those 600,000 jobs that are going begging.
And why is it we don't have enough American applicants to fill these jobs?
The training is not in place in North Carolina, and we have diminished the technical training all across America. Vocational education is expensive. It's more expensive than liberal arts, and therefore most institutions and legislatures have reduced the amount of technical training and budgets for technical training. So we are not training the workforce America needs to go forward. And the benefit of having a good program in North Carolina would be that it would greatly assist us in attracting new industry to North Carolina and to support entrepreneurism in this state. We've got some excellent programs, and the kind of new initiatives that are going on that I would commend, for instance, the biotechnology program in North Carolina is one of the newer programs. It's a high-quality program. It's a good example of the sort of thing we ought to be doing more of.
Well, you know, the thing is, well, when I went to school, my high school had three courses. Academic course, where everybody who took that course went directly to college. I had a vocational, commercial course, where people could go to college, but to the community colleges, they were being trained to do that, and a vocational course, where people learned automotive trade, wood carving trade, all those technical trades to be plumbers, and we haven't done that anymore. So we are actually driving out our own technical experts by not supplying a means for them to go further in school.
That's right, and as a result of that, a lot of the jobs in the United States for skilled workers are being filled to the extent they're being filled. They're being filled by craft workers trained in Europe, Germany, France, England, all of which have excellent vocational education programs. But the problem with that, as we all know, is that that drain of that talent from Europe to the United States is now hurting Europe. And in turn, that's hurting our economy as well. So right now, if we want to move forward in America and really develop the economy, we need to seriously consider putting in place a lot more extensive vocational education and more advanced technical training than what's generally available now.
Well, you know, I know that you're a lawyer, and the question I want to ask is I think it is very important for the Commissioner of Labor to be a lawyer for the simple reason that if you're dealing with labor laws and labor disputes, the law is very important.
I think that's right. And on top of that, in North Carolina, unlike Illinois, for instance, we have a law that says the Commission of Labor shall be the mediator of any labor dispute that occurs in North Carolina. And to do that, I think we need to have a legally trained Commission of Labor and someone experienced in mediation. And since I have that experience, in fact, I've mediated cases in years past, that's why I decided I needed to run this year.
Well, I think
that is so important, to mediation. See, that's what we were talking about earlier with diplomacy.
Right.
It's the lost art of being able to negotiate. And I think you're absolutely right, sir. We do need someone that is skilled in those talents.
And where can people call in if they want to assist your campaign or send you money?
I have a P.O. box for my campaign. It's Brooks Labor Commissioner, and it's P.O. box 27701, Raleigh, North Carolina, 27611.
27611 or 27601?
27611.
11,
downtown. Is our number 2 downtown post office in Raleigh.
Okay.
I'll be glad to give you a second address.
Go
it's
ahead.
516 North Blount, Blount Street, Raleigh, North Carolina, 27604.
27604, okay. Are you having any events coming up between now and November?
Not that I'm sponsoring, but we have a coordinated campaign for the 10 candidates for the Council of State, of which the Commission of Labor is one. And, of course, Dalton, Governor Dalton, is leading that ticket. We're all supporting that ticket from A to Z. We welcome support for the entire Democratic ticket, and we plan to work as a team to strengthen the economy of North Carolina and to carry on the business of the Council of State, which in itself is very important over and beyond the individual work of the various departments like the Department of Labor.
Well, I just want to thank you, John, for taking time out to coming on the show today. And anything we can do for you, just let me know. You have my contact information. And I hope to hear from you another time before the election.
I thank you, and I welcome that opportunity. In fact, we have about 4 events collectively that county Democratic parties are sponsoring across the state. We have about 4 every day. In fact, I'm in Moore County right now, beautiful Moore County, on my way to Anson County to an event there tonight. We appreciate all of the people who support the Democratic Party, and I ask for their vote on November the 6th.
I thank you very much. John,
could he give out his the P.O. box and stuff he did if somebody wanted to give to the campaign one more time?
P.O. box. Post Office Box 27701, Raleigh, 27611.
Okay.
And I want to thank you, John, and hope to hear from you. I'll give you a call and see when we can get you in again. But we need to get you in before the election.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's
okay.
A pleasure to have been with you. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Best of luck.
Bye.
That was John Brooks, who is running for the Commissioner of Labor in North Carolina. And the gentleman I have on, I'm glad you stayed on with us. Give us your name again.
Maurice, calling from Michigan. Right outside of Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Kalamazoo, Michigan. How is Obama doing in Michigan? I see he's up.
Yeah, he said like a seesaw, up and down, up and down, up and down. I don't know.
He's up now. What about your governor in Michigan?
I mean, to me, it's just a, I don't know, man. It's just, I, you know,
I ask myself, I don't see how the average American can really relate to the Republican agenda. I just don't. I don't get it, man. I mean, these guys are—they're so narrow in their thinking, and their ideology is so small-minded. I don't see how they can do it, and that would include the governor.
Well, what do you? Do you mind if I ask you what you do for a living?
Yeah, I own my own business.
Okay. Well, what type of business?
I own a dollar store and some real estate property.
Okay. How has the real estate fluctuated from where you were 4 years ago to where you are today?
I haven't really bought anything within the last 4 years, but that's a good question. I don't really know. I can say this, that I think what has hurt it more is the banks, for whatever reason, not lending more money and things of that nature. But as far as real estate prices, I just don't know. They've been kind of stagnant.
Well, you know, as far as the portfolios and what you have in stocks and whatnot, I can see a major difference in that alone. Because, as I said, my wife, she had stocks, but she worked in private. Anthony, now she works for the federal government, but when she was she was almost wiped out during the Bush years. And now those same stocks that we didn't sell because they were down, they are now we're back to where she was before the Bush administration came into office. So
yeah.
Are we better off than we were 4 years ago? Hell yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So from that perspective, yeah. Oh, yeah. I guess the housing prices were down dramatically 4 years ago, and I think that they are starting to rise a little bit. So yeah, I mean that's a no brainer, man. That's what I said, man. I don't know how these guys can hold on to any type of 49% of the base of the American population. I just don't get it.
Right. Well, hold on, Maurice, because I have another call. I want you to speak to this. Hello.
Mike.
Yes. Are you back?
Mike. This is Marshall.
Yes, go ahead, Marshall.
I think the gentleman from Kalamazoo is exactly right in speaking in terms of how can any American support the agenda of the Republican Party. But I go back and I think about something that Dr. E.B. Du Bois wrote about, and he said the problem of the 21st century will be the same problem in the 20th century will be the same problem in the 21st century, and it is. And it's all about race. That's the way the support comes in. And these guys are underlining using a de facto methods to bring that out. And it's coming out in a lot of the polls you see and a lot of the people who interview on particularly on these talk radio programs. You see it all really comes to light that our racism is alive and doing very well in America.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, this is...
Am I a racist, Mike?
What's that?
Am I a racist?
Yes, you're a racist.
Am yeah, I?
Right. Please, listen. Hey, all you know is that horses and Romney belong together.
Mike, seriously, would you call me a racist?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
But you know, I don't think we should take that lightly. This is Maurice again. I think now this with my definition of racism, I think we all are racist to a certain degree, and I think we've just given racism a negative connotation. To me, it's just having an affinity towards people that look like you, people that you have relationships with, and people that you endear to, and clearly, you know, that's been the history of this country. So I think we all have carried some.
Well, we all have our preferences and stuff like that. But, Maurice, I live in Connecticut. I can't tell you how many people, whether Republicans or Democrats, when Obama won, were so proud of this country that, you know, maybe we're getting past some of this crap. And I'm telling you, Republicans and everything else, you know, they didn't want Obama to win. But they said that, you know, I'm proud of the country for what, you know, what it did. I agree with you. It's still racism, and racism was horrible. I saw it a couple times when I was with Mike, you know?
Robin, I'll hold that thought for a bit. I wasn't...
How many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome? Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Mike, you're fading away. I can't hear you.
I said that was said by Paul Weinrich, the father of the conservative, well, I don't even want to use the conservative, the regressive party, because he's not a conservative. So, you see, there are people
founder,
out there.
The founder of the Republican Party, you're saying?
The founder of conservatism, Paul Weinrich.
Absolutely not.
Hey.
The Republican Party has been conservative. They've been around since, I don't know when, but Lincoln was a Republican.
But Nelson Rockefeller was a Republican, and we voted for him. Six times. And hold on just a minute. Four times, 16 years. Okay, I got to answer the question, Bob, that you answered before, but we have one other person that has to get in here.
Mike, you're fading out. We can't hear you.
Is that you? Well, I'm not moving. Hello, who's this on the line?
This is Linda Coleman on the line.
Linda,
can you hear me?
Yes, we got Linda Coleman on the line, who is the candidate for lieutenant governor in North Carolina.
Hi, how are you?
How are you doing?
I'm great. I am great. I hope you are.
Yes, I am. So, where are you at, and what are you doing at the present time?
I am driving at the present time. In about 2 seconds.
You are breaking up. You must be in one of them little.
No, you've been breaking up all the while. I have an iPhone. Thank you.
I saw that.
I have an iPhone, thank you. Am I still breaking up?
No, you're very close now, Linda.
Okay, great, great. Okay, I hope everyone is well.
Everyone is fine. This is Marshall
Harvey well.
At the end here.
Okay, okay. I'm still so excited about the convention that was in Charlotte last week. I am still energized from that convention. That was a great convention. Hello?
We're here. Can you hear me?
Okay. I can hear you well.
Well,
can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. I think we've lost Mike.
No, I'm here.
Mike, are you?
I'm here.
Okay.
Mike, you need to get your iPhone.
That's right. There you go.
I got Skype. I don't need iPhone. Listen, so, Linda, where are you at? We're in the race now. What's going on?
Well, let's see what is going on now. Well, I will tell you, I'm raising money. That's what I'm doing now. Going to events and raising money. That's pretty much what it is. Trying to get all of the exposure that I can and trying to raise money. Although I am up in the polls, it's still not enough where I can feel comfortable because there's still about 20% of the voters out there undecided. And so I've got to expand my communication plan so I can reach out to those undecided voters and move them in my direction.
Is that a large undecided voter?
20% is pretty big. Yeah, of course, that can decide an election. So, you know, there are lots of independents out there and lots of people who still have made up their mind. Probably some people I have not been able to reach, although I have been traveling quite a bit, so there's still some people out there I probably need to reach out to.
Okay, give us some contact information.
Yes, LindaColeman.org. If you can go to LindaColeman.org, you can find me and you can contribute to my campaign, because, of course, I will tell you, Mike, as you know, running a statewide race is really a tremendous feat. In the corner of the state, and that requires money. And so, Michael, can you hear me? I'm getting a lot of static.
I can hear you well, Linda. But
okay, now static. Go ahead. So give us the phone number, Linda, that we can call. What's the phone number?
Okay. Yeah. It is 919-834-2557.
Say that one more time.
919-834-2557.
Okay. And before we have to let you go, what is your main reason why you're running for lieutenant governor?
I am running for lieutenant governor because, as you know, our economy is in the tank. North Carolina has a really high unemployment rate. And working in the area of workforce development, and I've been in HR all of my over 30 years, and I have been in elected office. I am for well with the county, Wake County Board of Commissioners, as well as in the North Carolina House, as well as appointed to lead a workforce of 93,000. So I am working to bring jobs to North Carolina to alleviate some of the pain that our people are feeling as a result of this economy. I'm working to bring jobs here to connect the workers and the skill sets that they need to get into the jobs that will pay them a livable wage.
And we vote to the governor for North Carolina and give them that still represent.
I didn't hear that, Michael.
Give us the email address one more time before we go.
Okay. The website is www.lindacoleman.org, and my phone number is 919-834-2557. I hope that your listeners will really plug into that to see what it is I am all about, and I have the leadership and the experience to lead on this whole job and economy issue. I've got the past accomplishments. I've got the skill set. I have the leadership abilities. I can do it. And I hope that voters out there will look at my record and vote for in early vote as well as on November 6th. Linda Coleman, lieutenant governor of North Carolina.
Mike, did you hear all of that?
Yes, I got it all. And I hope to hear from you, Linda, again before November 6th.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Mike?
We're running for lieutenant. Yes, Marshall. Yes, go ahead.
Do we have another guest today?
Yes, I do. And she's waiting on the line. But I want to get first to Maurice. Maurice, what do you think the main thing has to be done in Michigan to correct some of the problems that you just talked about?
I think, Mike, the issues of Michigan are kind of the same with the issues of the other states as far as, the economy and things of that nature. And I really think that the once Obama wins re-election, that
the entrepreneurship and everything surrounding that, and particularly in the minority communities. I hope that that can be put on the front burner. Now, what exactly can be done with that, I'm not sure, but I think it needs to be put on the front burner. And I think, you know, that is one of the best ways to tackle the unemployment numbers. I mean, everybody knows that the highest numbers are in the minority communities. And so I think there has to be job creation there at the grassroots level, and that needs to be done with a focus on entrepreneurship.
Right. Okay. Well, if you want to say one more minute, I have one more person on here who is going to help everybody understand their inner self. Because, as you know, Bob, you need understanding for your inner self.
You're breaking up, Mike. I got to go. You have some good listeners, and I like your politicians, too. They seem to be on the ball. I'd be very interested in the labor guy as to what jobs they're looking for down there.
Hey, they're looking for anything.
You're breaking up, Mike. I'll give you a call later. Maurice,
all right.
Take care.
Okay, buddy.
Mike.
See you later.
Yes. I want to ask the gentleman from Michigan, since the auto industry is back, has he seen any improvement in the conditions within like Detroit and other cities within Michigan?
Now, I'm a little bit outside of about 2.5 hours outside of Detroit. So, you know, the specific impact, I probably could speak to that as it relates to Detroit and things of that nature. So I don't know about that.
Okay.
Let us now. I mean, you need to put it here because we're going to get some real good information about how you need to look at the rest of the world. Oh yeah,
Michael.
Yes, how are you?
Hey, it's Tawana. How are you guys doing?
How are you, Tawana?
Right.
Good. All this politics and everything. You know, best wishes to Linda on her run for lieutenant governor. All this stuff sounds great. But we're going to close out the show today and kind of turn everything inward into our own personal lives, okay?
What can you tell us?
Well, you know what? I've been thinking all week on this topic here, and it's called self-discipline. And I just want to give everybody 3 points to think about over the weekend, you know, how we can better ourselves this area of self-discipline. You know, we always want so much fast, but think we want all these, are we ready for these, you know? And one of the most important aspects of staying focused is having self-discipline. So, got to start with the small things in your life, you know, so that you can be prepared for the great things. So the 3 points I want to leave you guys with today on self-discipline is just think about your ability to say no. You know, so many things, so many ideas, so many people come across our lives. You know, when you have offers out there, have the ability to say no. You don't need to participate or chime in, what have you. Think about your ability know when it's time. Also, about how you manage your time, because that's a major part of self-discipline. Plan out your day. How well do you? That will also help you determine what kind of self-discipline you have. And then, on top of all that, your direction, goals that you're trying to reach. How much clarity do you have? What are you really trying to do? Because you always have people who throw out ideas at you, telling you to go this way, that way. Don't include them. But what clarity you have on your own goals, so you'll have the ability to your time better.
Well,
you know, so those are the points that I want to leave with you this weekend. And, you know, it's all about priorities. Take a moment and think about your priorities, what they are, where they are. Are you planning to see them in the next? I have you guys. Mexico?
And does that also even Hello?
I'm here. Are you here?
Yes. I said, does that also include me having another drink since I got finished with Bob or what?
I don't know. How many have you had?
I had none yet.
Give yourself a limit and don't pass it.
I will.
Okay? Start small. And the quote I want to leave you with, Michael?
What?
It's just simply, our level of discipline with small things will determine the possibility of success you have with the greater things.
Mike?
Yes. Okay.
You're so quiet, I can't believe she shut your mouth. I need to call her and take her with me when you and I get together so we can talk. You not get hysterical jumping up and down and everything.
I mean, Maurice, was I hysterical or what?
I don't know, man. I'm with the other sister, Linda. You need to get an iPhone or something.
I mean, if you tell me all the time, I need to do this and this and that, you need to get you an iPhone.
My phone is the Samsung, and I'm getting a new Galaxy very shortly.
Your phone? I didn't even understand that. What is your phone? Is what?
You guys pull my leg down. I'm talking on Skype. We're talking on Skype. So don't blame me. This is Skype.
Yeah. But you're utilizing your antique equipment.
Come on. No antique equipment. I got up-to-date equipment here. This is high-tech.
Well, you know, Radio Shack has been out of business probably about, not Radio Shack, but Circuit City has been out of business probably about 3 years now. And that's when you bought all your equipment, wasn't it?
Never got this.
Oh, my God. You mean these receipts?
Yeah, these receipts are no good anymore, huh?
Technology has changed so much since then, Mike.
Is that right? Well, hey, I just want to let you know. There's no such thing. And I wanted to play. I just want to make sure. Okay, I met a gentleman. We were at the before the convention started. We were at Thomas and I and Michael Evans were at the Occupy parade, and we were looking to see. And Thomas had asked this gentleman sitting over here on the bench. And he just ran to put this thing. I come to find out this gentleman is six lengths of four. And his wife. Hello? Am I breaking? I don't know why you're breaking up.
I don't know here.
I have no idea. What's that? And hey, can you hear me now?
Every other word.
Every other word. Well, I have no idea. Skype, there must be a storm coming or something. Because it's the only time Skype acts like that is if we're in the middle of a storm or a storm is coming. But you can hear me now, right?
I can hear every other word. I can feel like a fade out every now and then.
Is that right? Well,
yeah.
Let me see if I can dial and get a clean line here.
It's Maurice. I'm going to have to let you guys go. I just wonder if I could leave with one statement. One of the callers who had gotten on and talked about the issue of race, you know, and how it relates to what we're kind of seeing play out in America. I just think, and I think he's right on point. I think as African Americans, I think we would do a grave disservice to ourselves to ever take out of the equation of what we want to do socially and politically the issue of race and let that drive our thinking as you know what we want to see happen. I think we'll be doing a very bad mistake of taking it out. So
absolutely. And see, here's the problem that with these ultra regressive parties. Not a strong Republican Party. You don't have to be a Democrat. But one, you balance the other. Wow, that doesn't believe in anything. This is going to the chaos. And this needs to be straight. But, Maurice, I want to begin the show, and I thank you for calling in. And, no.
Okay. Yeah, have a good day.
I thank you very much.
Mike?
Yeah, we have a... It's a bad line. The Skype's got a bad line. So
okay,
listen.
Mike, I'm going to have to call you later.
Okay, gotcha. Call me later.
Okay.
That's why I have my margarita. All right, bye.
All right.
Okay. So, Thomas?
Yes, sir.
Now the line is clean.
Yeah, it's almost as if the more we add to it, the more it degrades. It's a bad connection.
Well, it was a bad connection all day today. And I just want to just say something that...
Is it the more you have to record that... The worst thing.
No, it's not that. I just want to have people understand that.
Well, could we also correct one fallacy that we
Yeah, correct had? That fallacy about the.
Okay. So, well, they were debating
we
amongst themselves. Mm-hmm. I looked it up, and they said it's a fallacy. It's on Snopes. It's on everywhere else.
Right.
Yesterday, our old friend, what's the name, Bud Hertz, and a right-wing blogger, one of these nice Glenn Beckites named Severin, started the rumor about Obama ordering them not to have bullets.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they said that a State Department embassy lady out in Cairo ordered this, okay? Completely false, utterly false, but it's been picked up and propagated throughout the right-wing blogosphere, and that's what our gentleman was talking about. Because they said it went around the right-wingosphere, and it's absolutely false.
The right-wingosphere. I like that. Let me
you
see.
Can look it up online. It's already been debunked everywhere.
Well, I just want to leave this while we got these one thing to leave everybody with this. Everybody, just remember that if you don't win, if you don't go out and vote, and Romney wins, it's all going to be over for you. And the Munster Man will be taking over. I want to thank all our callers today. I want to thank everybody who called in, and I want to thank Bob, and I'll be talking to you later. And I want to thank Maurice. I want to thank everybody that called in. And I will see you, Thomas and I will see you next week. This has been The Last Voice.